All right, so homework number one is now past due. Hopefully everybody got that in, or I checked shortly before I came and there were a few people who were apparently rushing. How'd that go? No problem? Physics in the first problem.
And then, like, whether the difference gets worse than zero. Like, I think fundamentally, I have the solution, but I'm not really sure why.
So, what happens? What do people get? I have the resistor there. I close the switch. I lose an equal amount of energy on the resistor as to what I put into the capacitor. I take the resistor out, and I lose an equal amount of energy to what I put in the capacitor. Why is that? Well, that in itself is a construct, right? There'll always be some resistance, some impedance there. So I think this limit is something we can only have analytically. But why does it happen? You look through a post in the solutions I'll post afterwards, I can kind of show a couple different ways to solve it. But essentially, if you want to solve in the time domain, it requires using math with Dirac deltas and taking integrals of those. But instantaneously, the capacitor voltage rises from zero to the input with a pulse of current that is a delta function exactly at the switch closing time with enough charge in it to bring the capacitor up. So simultaneously, right at that limit, I have a step function of voltage and a Dirac delta. If I integrate those two together, what I'm going to get is half CV squared dissipated on the switch.
Where did the energy go that was lost
on the switch? So this is a, I'll call a white lie that we teach early in power electronics, that ideal switches have no loss, because when it's on, it's a short. When it's off, it's an open, and a short and open don't have losses. That's all true. An ideal switch is not just a short or an open. It's something that switches back and forth between the two. This charging a capacitor in this way can still exhibit loss. Okay. That becomes important as we move forward. In reality, we'll always have that be a MOSFET. It'll have some resistance. We won't have this instantaneous pulse of current, but we'll have something pretty close. So in this problem, if I solved out what the current through the switch is, I sub F, I'd have just this instantaneous pulse with an amplitude equal to the charge supplied to the capacitor, so that when I integrate over this, I get that total charge. With any real switch, what I'll get is jump up to whatever VG over R on, and then if R on small, decay down pretty quickly. Probably should have drawn this a little bit differently, but such that the area in there is the same as what I would have gotten at that direct delta. So in the limit, these things become the same, but in reality, we'll always have some RC dynamics associated with that. Okay. Does that answer your question more or less? And there's, it wasn't a trick question, there's simple ways to solve this, either by intuition or by math using the chain rule, where you don't have to take an integral of the Dirac delta and know that in the limit, this becomes this, that's in the solution. So, quite a simple thing to solve if you apply the chain rule to the derivatives there. You'll see that in the solution. How many of you got that? How many of you got that the energy losses don't change? And how many people said the energy goes to zero?
I didn't know why.
The simple way to answer it is, when you add the resistance, you did this derivation, and here's the energy loss. Look at that expression. There's no R in it. It doesn't depend on the resistance at all. So if the resistance is 10, 100, a million, or zero, that expression is the same thing. That's the answer. Okay. That often trips people up. Grading will be lenient. Any other questions? Okay. I posted this again, mostly we're still on this topic, and I forgot to put it into the notes that I posted online. So more of a reminder to me to give you that link in an easier to access way. Okay, if no other questions, we'll move on. Last time we looked just a little bit into switching loss due to the output capacitance in this boost converter example. Saw that when a MOSFET turns on with a large drain to source voltage, all of the energy in this CDS capacitance is going to get shorted out. This is kind of the opposite of the case you worked on in your homework. Instead of charging it up through a resistance, I am discharging it through a resistance. This one's easier to think about because just all the energy is going to go away. Whatever energy it had is going to end at zero energy. And there's no source involved. Conceptually, we argued one way to improve this situation would be to have this capacitor get discharged in the same way it was charged, which was rather than having a resistive charging path, either shorting it out with the resistance or as in the homework, doing voltage source resistance capacitance, we can use something that looks like an inductor, more like a current source, which can then charge and discharge this capacitance without having this constraint of 1/2 CV² will be lost. So when we turned off the device in a normal small ripple boost converter, this inductor charged the capacitance up with very little loss. And we can do the same thing when we want to turn it on if we run in such a way that the inductor current changes polarity, such that the inductor current will then pull the charge out of the capacitance, boost this voltage to zero, and turn on the switch with zero voltage switching, ZVS. And you saw that gave some big improvement in our operation. This is the just example waveforms. This is the synchronous case running with large ripple, but we were able to charge and discharge that capacitance in a nice resonant manner. When we look at the energy in the MOSFET, these blips are really the energy going into and out of the capacitor. We see here, charge it up, put the energy into the capacitor, voltage stays high. And then during the MOSFET turn-on transition, just prior, we pull that energy back out, regain it into the circuit so it's not lost. If I integrate over this whole thing, I'd have very little total loss. This is drain-to-source voltage times drain current, so I'd have the conduction losses in that if I integrated over an entire period, and some residual switching losses that happen because my gate doesn't instantaneously go to zero. Other mechanisms that we'll talk about. End of this lecture or beginning of next. And then just briefly mention some other techniques, this quasi-resonant converter, which actually uses additional, what could be thought of as parasitic elements, but now they're no longer parasitic. They're actually intentionally designed and part of the operation to get unrealistically high efficiencies. Okay. And that kind of concludes looking at this example boost converter. A couple more comments here, and then we'll move on to start looking at switching loss in more detail. Okay. At the end of class, we talked about the difference between how we're going to treat resonant circuits in this class versus what we might have done previously. Fundamentally, something like a buck output filter is a resonant circuit, an LCR, so a damped resonant circuit. But we had simplifying assumptions, so we didn't have to deal with this kind of thing in 481. Okay, these are going to be large enough, my switching frequency is going to be fast enough such that the ripple doesn't really matter, and I can treat the voltage on the capacitors and the current in the inductors as DC. In this class, when we're operating with resonance, either solely during switching times or through entire switching periods of the converter, that's no longer going to be true. We have large resonant waveforms where we need to examine the resonant details. For example, here, where we have almost a half period of a sinusoid, we need to be considering the actual resonance. Small ripple approximations won't apply. Now, that being said, there are times where it will still apply. So, in general, things like if I've got a DC to DC converter, the output capacitance, I'm going to size that such that small ripple remains true. It's supposed to be my DC output voltage, I'm going to make the capacitance big enough such that it's nearly DC, really internal elements. there'll be some need to understand what's going on, recognize the waveforms to say whether or not the small ripple approximation applies. Almost every converter will have at least one element where small ripple is going to be a good approximation. If we're looking at it in this class, likely one that doesn't. Okay. So we do need to consider the full differential equations and the behaviors of that, but we won't make you solely use your Diffie-Q's knowledge. We'll develop some graphical techniques to deal with second order differential equations that can help analyze things more quickly. And then in that same vein, I just want to talk here about the behavior of this thing, this LC filter in the frequency domain, and how design around these resonant off-switching circuits differs. Again, in the analysis in this class versus EC 481. So in the frequency domain, we'd look at this thing and we'd write a perhaps a transfer function. H of S is my V out of S over V in of S. That looks something like 1 over S squared LC plus S L over R plus 1. And we could, by matching this to standard form for second order transfer function, we could write expressions for things like resonant frequency in radians is 1 over root LC. Q of this system is root L over R. R naught, and Q is R over R naught. Characteristic impedance, and then the Q. And if I wanted to plot the magnitude of this transfer function, magnitude of H of S on Bode type axes, my x-axis is going to be log of frequency. This would look something like 1 for a while, then have some Q, and then fall off at 40 dB per decade.
That's bad. Audio options. Mic. One moment. Is for some reason shut off.
Continues working. How about that? So in very small ripple type converters, I put my switching frequency out here, where switching frequency and any of its harmonics are severely attenuated by this filter. And what's actually passing through is really just DC and any intermediate frequencies that have to do with modulation. If I'm trying to change the voltage, I've got some frequency components, a step change in reference, step change in input. But everything having to do with switching really just sees some big attenuation. It gets killed, doesn't show up. Here, we're going to be looking at either switching frequencies or dynamics during switching intervals, kind of in this range. Near the resonant frequency of the circuit, where resonant circuits were supplying a PWM waveform near this frequency, and it's actually getting amplified, attenuating everything else. We're having sinusoids, large, hopefully lightly damped, underdamped oscillations in this frequency range. Okay. in the case of soft switch converters, like we just looked at the boost, we still may be switching out here, but during the dead time, we're looking at dynamics in this range. We're really focused here. Okay. Down here, if I look at the behavior of this filter in the time domain, like V out of T versus time, and I'm going to say I supply an input, V in is a step function U of T, 0 to 1 at time 0. So U of T does this. What is my response in V out? So it depends on the exact values of resonant frequency and Q. But in general, I could have something that does this. My Q is very low. Let's see. Q less than, let's say, a half. I could have something that does this kind of thing. Q about a half. And if Q continues to go up, something like this. And then eventually something like this. One reason I bring this up is if there was a question after class a couple lectures ago when we were looking at really the behavior here, and I made the claim that this is dictated by a resonant circuit, the same as is done here, and was asked, well, I've seen circuits where this just looks entirely linear, so at what point, what are the conditions in which it is not a resonant circuit? Okay. So these switching intervals in something like this boost are always resonant. So as I turn off the MOSFET G, I'm in a typical small ripple type converter, and I turn off this MOSFET VGS, dropping. My diode not on yet, the shock here otherwise. So this is just off, maybe contribute some capacitance. As I said before, it's really just in parallel down here with CDS. And as this MOSFET shuts off, what I'm left with is an LC circuit, voltage source biasing it. The MOSFET doesn't turn off instantaneously. I might have for a brief time something that looks like a current source, something that looks like a resistance here, but I'm still going to have LC resonance and then either damped or biased by some current source. The reason that in many cases we don't have to analyze this is when I look at, call this VDS, this is the time when the MOSFET turns off. Over here, the diode is on. So I know VDS is going to go from here to here. In between, the details of what happened depends on the values of L and C, the voltage between them. What I drew in our previous example, I said it's going to look something like this. Some nice kind of quarter sinusoid resonant waveform. If, well, that is a small piece of a resonance that would look like this if no diode ever turned on, no MOSFET body diode turned on. So here is my lightly damped resonant waveform. Okay. The amplitude of this is dictated by L, C, B, and the initial conditions when the MOSFET turns off. If I, for example, made inductance much larger and the initial current way higher, I could get a waveform that looks like this, larger L, IL, average value of the inductor current. And I'd say that looks more or less just like a linear transition. Fundamentally, that is still part of a resonant transition that would be gigantic, lower frequency because I've increased L, so the resonant frequency decreases, and higher amplitude because of the passive values and because of the initial current. So in that case, well, fine to approximate it as just a current source charging that capacitor. This is all you're solving. But still, fundamentally, it is part of a huge sinusoid. But sinusoids near the 0 point are fairly linear. Any small segment of any continuous waveform looks linear if I look close enough. So depending on the conditions, this could be significant resonant dynamics or very well approximated as linear. Questions on that? Okay. So, to summarize, when we start looking at these techniques for resonant operation and soft switching, there's some great things that come out of it, but some caveats that need to be addressed. So, advantages, we're able to significantly reduce switching loss, really focused on this COSF loss in the example, but can also address different mechanisms for switching loss, either through the same or different switching techniques. This allows us to get to higher frequency where switching losses may have limited us before. Again, that's not a goal, but it could be a pathway to advantageous characteristics of the converter, be a pathway to give us better bandwidth or smaller passive size. And we can reduce EMI by having slowed down resonant transitions instead of sharp edges, changing square waves to things that are more rounded, have lower high frequency harmonic content, well above the switching frequency. Another one kind of integrated into all three of these, and in particular that last resonant boost converter that I talked about, another advantage is integration of parasitics. Into operation. So we can have things like power loop inductance actually be a fundamental part of the circuit operation rather than being this parasitic that's just some delta from how we think it should operate that's causing loss. If we have significant parasitics, we can actually have them come into the circuit operation and be a useful part of it rather than truly a parasitic. Okay. Doesn't come for free though. The disadvantages, we're going to have increased stresses due to these resonant waveforms. If I showed, if I go to DCM, a much higher current ripple and therefore higher RMS for the same power, increased conduction loss. The resonant example, I showed a much higher voltage stress on the switch in order to get this resonant waveform. So for the same output power, both peak and RMS currents in many cases, or voltage in the dual case, causing higher losses potentially. And then the disadvantage is the complexity and analysis. Simple small ripple approximations don't apply. So it takes more effort to figure out how to design these things. By the end of the class, that won't be a problem anymore. So don't worry about that one. Okay, so when we're looking at practical implementation, there are some things that are going to limit us in how far we can go with this. Simulation example I showed nearly eliminated all switching loss, so I can just run this thing to infinite frequency and it'll be fine. Of course, that's not going to be practical. I'm going to just talk about some practical topics here in the next few slides. First, I want to talk about is gate drive. Gate drive is going to have limited ability to switch the MOSFET quickly, and also some power losses associated with actually switching it. Right? A gate drive, typically this triangle that we draw, is fundamentally in most implementations just a half bridge of its own, where if I tell the gate drive to go high, this device will turn on and pull the voltage up. If I tell it to go low, this device will turn on, pull the voltage down. That really is no difference in the circuit we just analyzed, except that it's not loaded by an inductor, a constant current or a resonant circuit. It's loaded by some resistor going to CGS, the gate to source capacitance, so the MOSFET, connecting to the gate and source terminal. So fundamentally, with this, VGS is not just an ideal square wave. As we go to higher and higher frequencies, it becomes more and more important to consider that it takes some time to turn on and turn off. During that time, the MOSFET is neither fully in triode nor fully in cutoff, and result in additional switching losses residing in the active SAT region. Additionally, you've seen now in your homework doing this, turning a switch on, charging a cap through resistance, then turning the low side switch on and dissipating the energy in that capacitor is going to result in losses proportional to capacitance in the square of the voltage. In most low frequency implementations, these losses are negligible. As you start to go up into the many megahertz, this can be a significant loss mechanism. This is not a loss that shows up in your input to output power measurement many times, because this loss is supplied from your gate driver voltage to the device and then dissipated back. It's not necessarily coming from the input voltage. Depends on how you derive this supply. This comes from the input voltage, then eventually it comes from the input voltage and that power will show up. If you have a separate supply for your gate drivers or your control logic, you won't see these losses in your input to output efficiency measurement. Okay. This is just some plot showing losses increasing at frequency as I try to drive faster and faster, I'm going to have more loss associated with the gate driver. Okay. The next one really relates to these higher RMS currents and the resonant times. I'm calling this TD over TS, or what's the amount of switching time compared to the switching period. So here I'm showing plots for, again, the boost converter, different voltages I had laying around, but fundamentally a DCM type boost converter. The time axis is normalized, 0 to TS, so that I can show different switching frequencies all on top of one another. And what you can see here is at 500 kilohertz, the amount of time needed for this resonant soft switching, I'm labeling TD, maybe some 5-10% of the total period. As I go up to 2 megahertz, that takes a longer percentage of the period. In fact, it's dictated by the resonant dynamics, should be relatively similar absolute time. As I try to switch faster and faster, that amount of switching time staying the same, and it's taking up more and more of my period. Okay. That means now I've got less and less time in which I have to get all of the power through to the output when the diode is on. So I'm having to pulse the higher currents to get the same amount of output power through, because it's a relatively smaller portion of my total period. And that happens on both transitions. So I keep going and going. Eventually I'm spending 80% of my total switching period just switching. I only have 20% to actually pull all the power from the input and send it all to the output. These I'm just circulating internally. Current from the inductor is going to the drain to source capacitor. No power is delivered to the output. Okay. So you can see as I go up in frequency, my RMS currents get even higher, even for the same actual output power delivery, because these dead times, these switching times are taking a longer portion of the period. Down here, just some experimentally measured waveforms from an example I'll show at the end of lecture today, just to show you do get these nice waveforms. You get a relatively faster transition here at the peak current, and then a very slow, gradual ZVS transition as the current goes negative in the boost converter type implementation. This switch node voltage, inductor current, gate drive voltage, the MOSFET. Should label those. Next one, one that I want to mention here that we won't spend significant time addressing in the class is thermal limitations. And this really has to do with how high is useful to push switching frequency. But I'm seeing that as I go higher and higher in switching frequency, all my passives get smaller and my converter shrinking and shrinking. Well, as I do that, even if I'm maintaining efficiency, I'm putting all of my power losses into a smaller and smaller area. It's going to make it more difficult to be able to keep that thing from overheating. I have the same heat flux in from those power loss, the smaller area. More concentrated, and the temperature is going to go higher. So this is some design optimization from a reference I put down here. As they vary switching frequency, they're showing from their models the size of their filter. DM filter, their differential filter, is decreasing monotonically all the way up to, in this case, 10 megahertz. You think, okay, my converter is getting smaller, this is beneficial. The problem is that their volume of their cooling system begins to take off, and eventually, going higher frequency, the total volume increases. This is one reason why this could happen. Additionally, depending on the complexity of your model, as you go higher and higher frequency, higher order switching losses, magnetics losses could take over and cause your total losses to go up. Again, requiring the volume to get bigger to get those losses down and to cool it. Okay. So fundamentally, as we play with switching frequency, there's going to be a limited range over which it gives us some benefit in terms of things like power density. Okay. And this, look through literature in the field, there is a number of groups working on what they call Pareto optimization. Pareto optimization is fundamentally a type of optimization where you look at two dissimilar parameters and say an optimal is a range where I don't know how much I want each of these, but this is the best I can do without hurting one of them. Okay, the idea is looking at things like efficiency, which I'll put here, beta, and power density, shown as alpha, how much power I can push through in a given volume. And if I go through and compute all sorts of different designs with different devices, different magnetics, different switching frequencies, I'll find that I can do a bunch of designs, and each one of them will have some characteristic in terms of efficiency and power density. If I continue computing these and have a ton of dots, eventually I'll get some curve that looks like I can get my highest efficiency if I have no constraint and make this thing as big as I can, do whatever I want. And as I try to make it smaller, I'm going to pay some moderate price in terms of efficiency. My efficiency will begin to decrease. I'll have a curve that looks like this. This direction, generally speaking, corresponds to an increase in switching frequency. Depends on what all parameters I'm adjusting here. If I start changing devices around, I might be able to get this direction. But assuming I somehow constrain the scope of what I can look at, such that this is a similar implementation, if I change switching frequency, I'll begin moving this direction. Okay, I'll take potentially a hit from the higher frequencies, the higher switching losses, but I'll get a smaller converter that I can by reducing the passives of it. And then at some point, those benefits will stop. And if I continue increasing switching frequency, I'm going to have really net bad design. Continue increasing, I'm not going to get any benefit in power density because of my cooling or because of high frequency losses, and I'm going to get bigger and less efficient. A Pareto optimal is anything in between these points, where I say power density and efficiency, I can't directly compare in a simple and rigorous way. I can't say two efficiencies are worth one power density, right? So anything on this curve is a point where the only way for me to increase power density is by decreasing efficiency. So any of these are in some sense optimal. Any design somewhere down here is non-optimal because I can choose. I can either increase the efficiency or I can increase the power density by changing the design. But anything out on this upper boundary, I don't have a formal conclusion on whether this point is better than this point. Depends on if 99% efficiency is more important than being a quarter of the size. Okay. This is Pareto optimal. That boundary is a boundary where to increase one of these parameters, I have to decrease another. I have to take a hit in something else. Okay. If I pick a topology, I pick devices, I pick a way that I'm going to design the magnetics, increasing switching frequency from the low end will push me towards higher power density for some limited range. If I then change up and look at maybe this was my CCM boost with silicon devices. I go to a DCM boost with wide bandgap devices. I get some different curve for that design. Maybe lower initial efficiency, but higher peak power density. Same devices, but going to DCM so that I have higher RMS currents. I'll take a hit in conduction losses back here, but reducing those switching losses allows me to get further to a smaller design while maintaining it. Reasonably high efficiency. Okay, in both cases, everything under the curve is a feasible design. So anywhere, black one, anywhere down here, something I could build, but why would I? Because they're worse than what I could do with the same technology, same switching frequency. It should be thrown out. Okay. Next one I want to talk about is magnetics, which we won't spend a lot of time on in the course. I'll give a little bit of comment about some of the things you need to address here and later on. But the design of magnetics become significantly more complicated as we go up in switching frequency for a couple of reasons. So on the left, what I'm showing is just a finite element simulation, some example transformer, flux density and current density. On this current density plot, to put some bias current through this thing at high frequency, the current begins crowding towards the outside of the conductors. I have higher current in the middle here. Due to things like skin and proximity effect. Not shown in these, but things like fringing losses, gap losses. Become worse as you go higher frequency. In many cases, those are very difficult to model through simple hand calculation because things like proximity effect and fringe losses really depend on exactly where you place the winding. Even if I know the number of turns and the size of the core, if by moving the windings around in the window area, I can get significantly different losses in some of these mechanisms. Often requires going to something like finite element, having a complicated procedure that analytically computes based on the geometry where the windings are. Okay. On the right, I'm just showing a set of Steinmetz curves for an example core material. Steinmetz parameters tell me that the loss is in the core for a sinusoidal excitation are something like some coefficient times delta B of the flux density to the beta times FS to the alpha times the volume of the core. This FS to the alpha term hertz as I go to higher frequencies. Alpha be on the order of 2 to 3 or more, meaning that losses are going to go up significantly as I go to high frequency. See that on these curves. If I have the same delta B, losses are significantly higher at 1 megahertz than at 200 kilohertz. Okay. Going to higher frequency can actually benefit you here because of this delta B to the beta term. Delta B is dictated by the volt seconds applied to the magnetic device. If I switch faster, I'm applying voltage for a shorter amount of time, my volt seconds go down. In a simple case, delta B is proportional to 1 over the switching frequency. FS is the switching frequency. These terms both vary. In order to figure out whether higher switching frequency will help me in terms of core loss or not, it's really what's the magnitude of these two things, beta and alpha. If beta is greater than alpha, then as I go to higher switching frequency, assuming all my waveform, my duty cycles, and voltages stay the same, this loss will go down. If beta is less than alpha, means that this term is going to dominate, and as I go to higher FS, my losses will get worse. Unfortunately, beta and alpha are nonlinear functions of F. FS is written in here. At sufficiently high FS, alpha is greater than beta for about any core material. As I go higher and higher, eventually my core losses, they're going to be worse. That wasn't clear. The point I'm making is, say I had a converter running at 50% duty cycle with an input of 10 volts. The total volt seconds applied to some magnetic component are 5 volts, 10 times 0.5. If I double the switching frequency, I'd move here. But if I keep that same 50% duty cycle waveform, and I increase the switching frequency, the integral of that voltage is going to drop in half. So at the same time that I double the switching frequency, I'll cut my delta B in half. Here was I have 0.2, 0.4. So I would actually move in this case here and have slightly worse core loss, but not this much. Okay. Whether or not that applies depends on your converter topology. How does it respond to that increased switching frequency? Do I keep the same volt seconds? Do I drop volt seconds? And in particular, it relates back to comments here about here, my waveforms don't look the exact same. This doesn't look like the exact same duty cycle as I shift around in frequency. Okay. But from my conclusion, magnetics can be the limiting factor. Even if I can say to keep the same ripple as I go up in switching frequency, all goes down, well, the actual implementation of that may become more difficult. At high enough frequency, there's almost no core material you can use. Very high frequency converters are often using air core inductors. And I believe the last one I want to talk about is circuit modeling. And we'll do a fair amount in the coming lectures of modeling of these losses. The approach to that is we're going to look at an individual mechanism at a time. Kind of in the vein that we did previously, we've considered an ideal MOSFET with just a drain to source capacitance. And we'll look at a non-ideal MOSFET with no capacitances, look at some of these different behaviors. But actually in circuit, what we have is a non-ideal MOSFET with some transfer characteristics. Just give it non-linear behavior, jumping between three operating modes, cutoff, active fat, triode, even that's somewhat of an approximation to the real behavior. And around that, I have nonlinear voltage-dependent capacitances, I have parasitic inductances just in the device itself. I also have some connection to an external circuit, and I have a gate driver that's non-ideal, attribute additional behaviors. I try to model all of these things together. It becomes extremely complex. Here I have many different resonant frequencies depending on which pairs of inductors and capacitors I'm looking at. And nonlinearities in both the passive and active elements. This is, again, from an example publication where they tried to model just this circuit here, the inductance on the drain, source, and gate, three capacitors and a nonlinear device. They did fairly well, their model compared to experimental results, about 1% difference in predicted efficiency in a 90% efficient converter. Their losses are off by about 10%, right? 10% of the power is going to losses. They're predicting 9%, 10% error. Okay. Depends on the operating point. Some were worse, some were better. Okay. Incorporating all these things at once, at some point, you get useless expressions. You want to include all this complexity at once, can't go to simulation, right? So the models that we'll develop in this course are going to be simplified by looking at a single element at a time so that they are useful enough to work with and gain intuition, but they're not going to be these complex page-long nonlinear equations. At that point, circuit simulators are great at doing that. Them do their job. I can't look at a page-long equation and gain any insight about, hey, what can I do to fix this? Okay, quickly an experimental example here just to show that this all actually works. So some previous work that looked at comparing in a boost converter, silicon and a silicon carbide Schottky diode, how the switching losses vary. This was a 150 to 400 volt, roughly 300 watt boost converter. And these first waveforms are with the silicon diode. It's operating in DCM here. You see the inductor current dropping down below zero. Zooming in on that, even though we have a low ramp rate, we can see a little bit of reverse recovery type behavior where the inductor current goes below zero, but the switch node voltage still clamped high. That's what we called TA in our previous model. And eventually, any residual charge, minority carrier charge in that diode is removed. It can shut off, and because we're in DCM, we get this nice resonant transition, bring the switch node voltage down, very close to what we show in the simulation. Doing so does increase the conduction losses relative to a small ripple, CCM type converter, but can reduce the switching losses. Okay. So for this soft switch, DCM type silicon boost converter, where I'm still using a PN diode. It's got 98% efficiency at 100 kilohertz switching frequency. The loss mechanism is really dominated by conduction type losses, R on, RL, voltage on the diode. As I go to 1 megahertz, see a significant drop in the efficiency, more than doubled my total losses, nearly, well, more than tripled. And now reverse recovery type losses are dominating the total loss breakdown with this PN diode. Okay. Using a silicon carbide, which really should be shown as a Schottky diode, run the same test. There's now virtually no reverse recovery because of its Schottky nature. It means I can have these nice resonant transitions, but I won't have that reverse recovery loss. When I look at the loss breakdown, it's almost entirely conduction losses that can be verified by running at 100 kilohertz, 1 megahertz, 2 megahertz. In all cases, the efficiency is about the same, around 98. There's almost no penalty because there is very little switching loss. If I increase the frequency, I get little degradation in efficiency. There is still some, and these are what we call second-order switching losses. It's not main capacitance. It's things like the nonlinearity, the switching of the actual MOSFET, things like the inductance of the loop that still cause some residual loss mechanism, as well as increases in AC losses on the inductor. A couple slides here on how far this can go. So this is some work that looked at using a gallium nitride type switching device designed for RF applications in switching power electronics. I think some, this is just a buck converter, but with the FET itself grounded, so that the output becomes floating. Here, we're looking at the extreme limit of how fast we can switch this device. We're able to switch on and off in 750 picoseconds in this case. This in the limit, this waveform is not at all what the converter does. And that's because this FET here had 1 picofarad of drain to source capacitance. And the probe used to measure it has 4 picofarads. So we're getting 5 times the capacitance just to try to measure anything that's going on in here. We saw a significant drop in efficiency whenever we try to probe any voltage. Okay. This, about a 50 to 100 megahertz switching frequency at 78% efficiency in a 28 to 20 volt buck converter. Okay. In that same vein, kind of the limits of what's being researched now in what's called very high frequency power electronics from another reference. It's just one example. So MIT and Stanford working in this area, running things up in the 110, 100 plus megahertz switching frequency range, getting efficiencies close to 90. This one is actually a different converter than what I'm showing here and here, but this one didn't have a picture just to show you. These air core inductors. At some point, this magnetics limitation actually begins, as I said, forcing you the other direction where I could do a very small inductor with a core. This thing could be much smaller than this, but those core losses are so high, I have to actually go to something bigger with an air core to get smaller inductance without the core material. The magnetics start getting bigger again, small here. These converter topologies are derived from what's called Class E. It's kind of RF amplifier converter topologies exist at the boundary between power electronics and RF type design. Their goal is to switch with very low switching losses. And since I'm out of time, we'll talk about why next class. It's just last thing from this introduction. This course, we're going to cover topics, high frequency power conversion, soft switching converters and resonant converters, as well as some applications and some techniques to analyze these things. A little bit of passive design and practical issues. So next class, we're going to dive in and we're going to start analyzing first hard switching loss modeling, and then we'll move into design of soft switching converters. Okay. Have a good weekend. Long one. We'll see you Wednesday.